This is the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. This week we're going to be talking about the recent initial results announced from the polling inquiry. Obviously this is a polling podcast, and as we know, at the last general election, the polls incorrectly called the election as a neck and neck race between the Conservatives and Labour, whereas of course the Conservatives won a majority. Obviously the polling industry wants to understand a bit more about why this happened so this can be fixed in the future. And this week, Professor Pat Sturgis from the University of Southampton, who's chairing the inquiry and also leading a team of academics, announced some of his initial findings. In the coming weeks and months, I hope to be speaking to some of the people involved in the inquiry. But for now, I'm joined by Mike Smithson, obviously, of this parish, who to go over some of his thoughts and discuss some of the topics coming out of Tuesday's presentation. Mike, welcome back to the show. Mike, before we go on to discuss some of the issues, I thought I'd summarise for the listeners, you know, some of the initial things coming out of the inquiry, particularly for those who maybe know that it's going on but don't really understand what's happening. I think that there were some things that Pat Sturgis mentioned which I thought was worth calling out. The first was that he said the pollsters were pretty cooperative and transparent, which is obviously welcome. I thought one of the interesting things was that this doesn't seem to be a problem that it's new, actually. I think Will Jennings produced a chart, which I think has been shared widely, that showed actually the Conservatives being understated and Labour maybe being overstated has been maybe a longer-term problem since the 80s that's been going on, that's maybe getting worse, and perhaps in elections that haven't been close, it's not really been noticed as much. I think the bulk of the presentation, this again for the listeners' benefit, was about ruling things out in terms of what went wrong. Mode, into survey mode, which I know we'll come on to and you've had some thoughts on, Mike, was generally seen to be not a big issue. So what we mean by that is whether surveys were conducted on the telephone or online. At the very least, I think the initial conclusions were that wasn't the main reason, at least. Late swing was largely ruled out as at least the main explanatory factor. There might be some aspects of late swing, but doesn't again seem to explain why a neck and neck race was called when the Tories were maybe 6 or 7 points ahead. Obviously, Servation, one of the pollsters that have sort of argued that maybe there was a late swing with their poll that wasn't published. On that note, they talked a little bit about herding, and this is something that Dan Hodges has written about a lot with a great deal of cynicism, which I suppose to the untrained eye you can understand, and the polls did seem to be saying lots of different things and then converged on the same result. The evidence was slightly ambiguous there. There was evidence of companies changing methodology during the campaign. That's not necessarily a cynical thing. People will do that as we get closer to the general election. And actually it seemed to be that if there hadn't have been changes, the result might have been even worse. So barring some malpractice that's impossible to detect, That seems to have been ruled out that there was any malicious herding, I guess, if you like, in terms of people all trying to get the same result as everyone else, just so they're not the one that's out there on a limb. Having said that, of course, we do know Servation didn't publish a poll by their own admission. I'm sure they wish they had. So, perhaps there were other unpublished polls we don't know about. I doubt it, because media organisations pay for that, but it's possible. Now, the main issue that was raised, essentially, there's a debate around turnout. So, for example, were we getting the right people in polls, but maybe not adequately predicting how likely they were to turn out or not? The obvious example here being that the over 65s are generally twice as likely to turn out than the under 18 to 24s. Or could it be to do with sampling, meaning are we actually getting to the right people in the first place? There's a nuanced differences there, but I think that the inquiry's initial implication seems to be that it's to do with getting the right people and sampling. And some of the examples that they used there was that in terms of getting the older cohorts, the over 65s, it was very much skewed towards the 65 to 70 year old respondents and didn't get enough of people aged 70 and over. Likewise, the 18 to 24s or the younger voters that were found in surveys generally were the more engaged, switched on, more likely to vote Labour rather than maybe the more apathetic, disengaged that we're used to. So lots of interesting sort of initial implications. I think the inquiry was very quick to say that these were initial and there is a full report in March. But I guess, Mike, to bring you in, get some of your thoughts there. I mean, you were there as well. We were both there in the audience. What were some of your implications and key takeaways?
I was actually rather disappointed. I was expecting something more specific. We'd heard the element of, yes, far too many Labour supporters are being in samples and far too few Tory supporters are in samples. And I do think that one of the problems that the industry faced was that back in 2010, the previous general election, Labour was understated by the polls by about 2-3%. And certainly that made people much more guarded about making the sorts of assertions about the polls always overstate Labour. And I think that came up, and it was quite an interesting contribution from one of the BES people suggesting that the overstatement of the Lib Dems in 2010, the polls all had them at about 28% and they came out at just under 24%, that they found in follow-up surveys post 2010 that people were still saying that they voted Lib Dem, and they still came up with this 28% figure. And there was a sort of view that that group of voters who maybe switched away from voters but who didn't actually vote but told pollsters that they were going to vote, they in 2010 were saying they were voting Lib Dem. In 2015, that same segment were saying they were going to vote Labour when they didn't.
So essentially that almost, I mean, it might be youth-related, it might not be, but that cohort on the left that led to the Lib Dems being overstated in 2010, obviously switched because of the coalition and, you know, and being upset with Nick Clegg and so forth. Then were the same people that were overstating Labour this time around.
I think there is something in that, but there is also, you know, we it is absolutely right that over a period of elections, Labour gets overstated very rarely. The Tories get understated in most elections, and I think that is a factor. And I think it resembles the fact that Conservative voters are less likely to want to take part in phone polls if they get called. They're less likely to be taking part in online surveys. They're less likely to doing which is basically a group of those who are engaged within in the process. And it's all about, in general elections, you're trying to find the most marginal voters. One of the key things I think was I was actually disappointed in the polling inquiry report was there was a lack of any real view on modal difference. So we had the based on final polls, certainly it was very hard to see a modal difference online versus phone. But if you looked at the polls during the campaign, what happened was, I think there were 192 polls during the campaign, and that only 10% of those which were carried out by phone actually had had Labour leads, but 56% of those which were carried out by online, those had Labour leads, and that is that is not just a fluke. There is an element of issue there,
and I think the counter argument to that, of course, is that the final polls were, in terms of modal difference, were virtually identical, weren't they? So there may have been something earlier on in the race. I think Comrades wrote some blog posts on this, but then when it fundamentally came to it, that wasn't there. But then that's only going to sort of spike the conspiracy theories like theorists like Dan Hodges. You think, there was a difference, but then everyone manipulated their numbers to get to the same result.
I do think we do underestimate how critical final polls are to pollsters. And it is far better, if you're going to be wrong, it's better to be wrong with everybody else than to be 4-5% out. When, say, Servation had published their 6% Conservative League poll, we know now that they would have been the heroes, but they could have got that very wrong, and people would have dismissed Servation for years to come.
And I know
the chief executive of Servation very well, and he talked to me at great length about at the time about why they'd done this, and I understood it. It was too much a gamble.
It was a real world commercial, reputational issue, isn't there? You've got to always, any responsible chief executive is going to have in their mind. I mean, do we have to think differently about polling in the future? I mean, one of the things that I've been mulling over is that, you see in America, for example, it's often universities are heavily involved in this. And I think one of the things that Ben Page has mentioned is that there isn't really a lot of funding around for speculative, maybe if that's the right phrase, research internally within research companies. Political polling, insofar as anyone does it, and my firm doesn't, other than the exit poll, which of course was spot on, plug. No, but on a serious note, the teams are usually quite small. There isn't really a lot of budget because to do this research. Because for the very good reason that, again, if we go back to this commercial aspect of research firms, the money is not in this, it's in other things. And therefore, if you're a sensible business, you're going to plough your R&D money into some of those products that you think are going to make the business money. It's just sort of common sense. But at the same time then, that means that do the universities have to step up? Because at the moment, what we've got, pretty much, barring some relationships, are pollsters doing polls for the media quickly and as cheaply as possible for the very good reason that they're not really making any money off it, and it's all about their sort of PR-able marketing activity and getting their spokespeople in front of on TV channels and radio or whatever. Whereas maybe we need the LSE or Oxford University funding some of this stuff, much like the BES and all the rest of it. I mean, what do you think about some of those
points? I think that would be a very good development. It's very interesting following the US race at the moment. The proportion of the quality polls that are coming out that are university instigated is quite high. And it's interesting how you see them. They're also very regionally based, so you're getting a lot of New England polls coming out of Monmouth in relation to New Hampshire and so on. And I think that's a very positive development. I mean, I do think that there is a problem. I mean, the polling industry has traditionally looked to political polls not to make money, but to, as you say, to promote themselves. It's all about public relations. Now, the fact that there's a reverse impact because they were perceived to have got it very wrong in May. Mm. Therefore, has a negative impact. So that the idea of being in political polling is not there's no financial advantage anymore. So in fact, the GFKs who's probably in a better position as a result of not actually being involved in the general election.
As a result of not actually doing anything.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I suppose if you're trying to convince people to do it, then there's a big reputational risk and not a lot of reward in terms of revenue. So I suppose it's going to be challenging. I can't speak for any other organisation, but one of the things that I'm going to be interested in is will some of these, I don't know if traditional is a fair word to use, that conjures up maybe the wrong image, but some of these more traditional firms that are maybe bigger and don't have a large amount of, don't produce a large amount of political polling anyway, I'm thinking of sort of maybe ICM or to a lesser extent Ipsos, although they have their political monitor, maybe they won't bother in the future.
I think that Ipsos Mori would continue. I mean, they've been around doing this for longer than anybody else. And I think Ben Page was saying that they employ 1,500 people, of which three are involved in their political polling. And I think that Ipsos Mori has been very successful at the way it uses the limited polling it has to promote the company. Mm. They've what I like about them is that there's a consistency of approach. Mm. So you can actually, questions that were asked in this format in 2015, they were asked in 1976, 1977, when the firm started out. So you could look back and you see, you could actually make real comparisons.
Yeah.
You might not like the specific question wording, but at least you can see how
I think the mode may have changed over time, but a little bit, you're right. I mean, I think that it's nice when you've got Jeremy Corbyn or whoever the new Prime Minister becomes, you're able to compare them historically and make judgments off the back of that. And one of the points I wanted to raise, actually, what I've thought about this, is that for the listeners who maybe are not pollsters and maybe don't follow some of this stuff, I would make the point that what we're talking about that went wrong is a very highly specific aspect of research, which is about voting intention, which is about not just about what do you passively think in terms of public opinion on, let's say, Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, or if you take politics completely out of it, what do you think the top issues are facing the country? Is it immigration? Is it the economy? Is it the NHS? Yeah, those are matters of public opinion, which you can still, I think, reasonably get if you accept that the absolute figure itself isn't too important. It's the ranking, it's the kind of horse race choice, because those are passive measures that you can never actually prove. Whereas on the flip side, voting intention is about future hypothetical human behaviour in a hypothetical election, yeah, which may or may not be around the corner. And you're also, if that wasn't difficult enough, you've also got to make sure you're getting to a highly specific group of people, which is voters. One of the things you've written about, Mike, on that note is about we should not really worry about voting intention as much. We should look at sort of the leader ratings or economic trust. I mean, what's led you to, other than the obvious, I suppose, which was that the polls were wrong in May, what's led you to that position?
Well, if you look at historically, that you look back at every election, certainly since that we've got records for where there's been polling, every election from 1979 onwards, the leader ratings have been absolutely correct. The leader ratings in 79 had Maggie Thatcher just ahead of Jim Callaghan. In 1992, which was this extraordinarily close election, apparently from the polls, where we went on into polling day and people assumed that we were going to get a Labour minority government. What happened? John Major achieved the highest satisfaction levels in the leader ratings that any leader has ever achieved prior to an election in modern British polling history. And there was something about John Major that people liked compared with Neil Kinnock, and we should have, you know, realised then that in fact this was a much better indicator of where we were going. The same went in, if you look at every election that there's been of recent times, that the leader ratings have always provided a much better indicator of what's going to happen than the voting intention. And I think you're right about voting intention. It's a very complex question. You're not saying, what do you think about this? You're not saying, no, do you have a favourable view of this? Which is a simple question to answer. It's asking, will you, at some future date, take such a specific action? Mm-hmm. It's a big ask. And I think that the way that the British polling industry asks that question right at the start of surveys also is very strange. And I think that has a distorting impact. And I think There was a Labour Party survey handled by the Greenberg firm, which was carried out by phone, which I happened to be part of the sample, but that's...
Did they weight you down or up?
No. I thought, this is very strange. You know, I'm doing this phone survey on a Sunday afternoon. The phone survey was being carried out by ICM. They were using their calling centre. Mm. And I couldn't understand why they didn't ask me the voting question until near the end of the interview rather than at the start. And then talking about it with the company later on, they reckon that is actually a much better approach. You're getting people thinking about the political process. Certainly, you've gone through consideration of Ed Miliband's image, David Cameron's image, and all the other leaders. And people are probably giving a more considered response if the voting intention question is asked right at the end. So I do think it is a very, very difficult thing to ask. And I made a terrible mistake in May 2015, like many, many others. I believed the polls. I believe we were heading for a hung parliament with it being a toss-up whether going to be Labour or Conservative won most seats. And, you know, that was my mistake, and I look back and try to think, well, were there any other indicators? And I think the real indicator that showed the problems that Labour and Ed Miliband had was that if you looked at all the leader ratings, you looked at the portion of Labour voters who were giving a top rating to Ed Miliband, he was at the most on 70%, when Cameron from Conservative voters was getting 90-95%. And that to me suggests that
I mean, to give to give Ben Page and Comrades their due, I mean, I think they come at it from slightly different angles, but if, unless I've misunderstood, they both talk about two different sides of the same coin, I think, in terms of turnout. You know, Comrades have their turnout model, don't they, that they've since developed since the election, which, you know, at least gets us to numbers that feel perhaps closer to what we think reality might be, but whether or not that's going to be borne out in the future, you know, question mark. But also Ben Page talks about lazy Labour, and I suppose there is a certain aspect of common sense, isn't there? If you've got Labour supporting sample within your poll, which isn't particularly enthusiastic about Ed Miliband, there is a certain common sense to saying, well, actually, maybe that is going to be less likely to turn out. But I know that one of the things that I'm certainly looking at in the future is there seemed to be a bit of a disagreement in the room, which I think is fine. Yeah, I think we should be sceptical about unanimity at this stage, less than a year after it. But there seemed to be a bit of a disagreement as to whether this was turnout related or whether this was sampling related, or the scale to which each was important. But I guess we're going to wait and see what happens there. But, I mean, moving on, I mean, what, does this all matter? I mean, one of the things that I've been interested in is there's been a lot of people, particularly on the Labour side, which have actually been quite angry about the way the polls were wrong. There's been several people that have mentioned this, but Ben Bradshaw comes to mind. I think I saw him on Twitter recently saying that he felt that the polls being wrong had an influence on the actual election outcome, which would only strengthen, I think, Lord Foulkes's sort of claims to statutory regulation, whether or not you believe that's the solution. But, you know, ultimately, you know, if what pollsters are producing is influencing our democracy, then there is an argument there to maybe greater regulation. Let's get your thoughts on those two things. Do you think, A, that the election was influenced by the polls in terms of the actual outcome? And B, what do you think about some of Lord Foulkes's plans?
Yeah, I think the election was completely influenced by the polls, that the whole Conservative narrative suggesting that you were going to get chaos, raising the prospect of what's going to happen with the Scottish Nationalists, was all driven by the polls. We had, you know, first of all, obviously the polling that was coming from Scotland suggesting that Labour was going to be nearly wiped out there, which was proved to be accurate. That created a sort of the spectre of a really difficult problem for whoever was going to, you know, come out on top, but assuming there was going to be a coalition. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, I think that the if we'd have known, if the polling had been showing 6-7% Conservative leads throughout, there wouldn't have been the same concern, I would suggest, amongst Conservative voters about the outcome. I think you probably wouldn't have got as much sort of tactical switching. What the Tories did in the Lib Dem seats was absolutely brilliant in terms of identifying potential switchers, really saying, well, the country needs certainty, and got huge switching from 2010 Lib Dem voters to voting in the marginals where it really mattered, to voting for the Conservatives. And that was actually driven, the narrative, by the polls. If you remember, you know, every news bulletin, it was all, you know, it was all that we're going to get chaos after the election. Mm. That was the way it was, and that came out of the polling.
But then I suppose the counter argument there is that I do share the view that if the Tories had been 6 or 7 points ahead, maybe their economic plans would have either A, been scrutinised much more closely, or B, maybe not have been what they were. If they felt that they were going to win, maybe they would have not produced the manifesto they did. I mean, there was some evidence, at least anecdotal, from some people behind the scenes that suggests that, you know, the Conservative manifesto was a starting point in a negotiation that they expected to happen, rather than what they would have necessarily done if they had a free rein. So it's an interesting debate there. But I suppose if you take the view that the polls were consistently wrong, and I guess we could never know this, and what I mean by that is that, you know, if they were 6 points out, they were consistently thus. They didn't seem to really move very much, did they, during the sort of election campaign?
There was hardly any movement at all. That was the
So that would suggest that the SNP narrative wasn't necessarily this great provider of switching that we might think it is. If the polls were quite flat, and I guess we never quite know whether they would have been, if they'd been accurate, whether they would have moved, then presumably minds were made up a long time ago on Ed Miliband, but it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe the SNP was a proof point to that, but actually the decision was made.
the critical thing about the election was that how well the Conservatives did in the marginals. They held on to far more seats than anybody thought they were going to hold on to. They won far more seats from the Lib Dems and others than anybody thought they were going to do so. And I think that that of itself came out of the narrative that had been created by the polls. And I think that that the chaos theory was something that they put forward very well, and I think that that was a fantastic victory, and I think that the sort of Linton Crosby approach was actually really helped by what we were seeing several times a day for that hectic 4 weeks last April.
But let's talk a bit about the future. I mean, I suppose, where does polling go from here? It strikes me that, in a common sense, irrespective almost of what comes out in March, a common sense reaction will be that polls just won't be taken as seriously. I mean, it was a shame, really, that there were lots of very smart people doing lots of election modelling on various websites that was really impressive, based on fundamental VI numbers that were wrong. So you try to drill down into constituency-level polling, it's almost irrelevant if you've got the fundamental national picture wrong. It's ironic, really. I remember Lord Ashcroft was saying that the national polls were just mood music. Well, I mean, I understand where he was coming from when he said those things, because obviously what he was saying was that it was these are won and lost at the marginals. It's 650 races, not one. But at the same time, if you're getting that fundamental spread wrong, it's wrong. And I suppose that's just going to, we can expect politicians just to, who maybe have negative polling that they were rather wouldn't, just to poo-poo it, basically.
Or we see it at the moment that Jeremy Corbyn is having the worst leader ratings of any Labour leader, even worse than Michael Foot, consistently at the moment. And what happens? Corbyn backers within the Labour Party say, well, who believes the polls anymore?
Irony being, of course, that it was Labour that seemed to be the beneficiary of some of the polls
before. Yeah, but I think that it is actually undermining the true position, or not the what the polls seem to be suggesting about perceptions of Corbyn, and you're getting the same issue again about Labour voters. What was it polling out this week from YouGov? Only 45% of 2015 Labour voters prepared to give a good rating to Corbyn. That is the recipe for real disaster. And I mean, whatever we think, and even if the polling is out by some measure, those sorts, the scale of that is something which really it suggests that Labour's in trouble there.
So polling matters even when it's wrong, dare I quote the title of the podcast. And of course there may be trouble ahead, mightn't there, when we look at the EU referendum polling. I know you've looked at some of this, and I think comrades have produced an interesting blog article on this too. There does seem to be that modal difference that maybe was sort of there but then didn't really materialise at the general election. Does seem to be really there with the EU referendum polling, doesn't it?
I think, yes, Commerz actually have been quite admire what they've been doing of late. All the telephone polls since the general election on the EU referendum have had very big, at least double digits, some leads for Remain 20% and higher. Whereas the online polls are showing a race that's much closer. In fact, of the four polls that have been published so far in 2016, all online, three of them have got to leave ahead. Now that's fine, except that Commerz did a study last in December when they produced their last phone poll. At the same time, they also did an online poll to test it against. And their phone poll had a 19% Remain lead, whereas their online poll at the same time, same questions, had the parties virtually even Stephen. And that's, that really highlights the big modal difference there is. I've been looking at some of the detail on that. And one of the problems seems to be that you're getting a very different picture from the elderly, from 65-plus voters. If you look at the online polls, there you're seeing 20-30% leave leads. if you look amongst the older right. age groups, and these are the critical people because they all vote, and they turn out and so on, and they're increasing segment in society. But in the phone polls, you're seeing maybe 1%, 2% leave Leeds from that very same segment. And I think that seems to be why you've got this difference. And I'd suggest it comes down to the fact that if you take part in an online poll, you're showing a level of engagement in the process in the first place.
So let me just clarify, which way around is that? So the older audience are much more likely to leave online.
Yeah, much more likely to leave online. They're about to even Stephen by phone. And that's, you know, the data is all there. I've been meaning to do some fancy charts to just illustrate that. I probably will do over the next few days. But it is a big factor. The same goes with Conservative voters. Conservative voters are
who are older usually as well.
Overwhelmingly to leave online. They are split almost down the middle by phone.
There's an interesting debate here, and it's generally fascinating, where, you know, traditionally older voters skew conservative. That's that's not a new thing. But actually, at the same time, you would have thought would be more cautious about, you know, fundamental changes to the status quo at the same time. So there's almost, you know, so the skewing conservative bit, you would imagine older voters would be more likely to vote out because of that sort of, you know, small C conservative viewpoint, maybe on Europe and immigration and things like this. But on the flip side, might be more akin to the status quo. So you've almost got two dynamics pulling in different directions there, haven't you? So it's going to be really important to get that sampling right.
I mean, we saw during the Scottish independence referendum that it was the older voters who actually kept Scotland part of the union by quite big margins. Change is something that people are less likely to like as they get older, and I think we will see that more and more.
Well, certainly many challenges for the polling industry to face. We may be back, I think you mentioned yesterday, having another inquiry sooner than we think. Before we go, let's spend 5 minutes talking about the US presidential race. I know that's something you've been following closely, as have I. I mean, what's your current view on the state of that? I mean, it seems to me that my sort of take is that Hillary Clinton's looking quite vulnerable versus Bernie Sanders in Iowa and New Hampshire, but probably has the beating of him nationally. Now, I know national polls aren't the issue, the state-by-state races are, but she has 20-point leads in some of the southern states and things like this. So I still feel it's hers to lose, but there is this drip, drip, drip of email-related things which may really hurt her. On the flip side, I mean, I might be getting jittery as we get closer, I don't know, but I'm starting to wonder, are we just ignoring what's right in front of us, which is that Donald Trump's in the lead and has an extremely good chance of not only getting the GOP nomination, but if he gets to a 50-50 race versus Hillary Clinton, yes, he has his problems with Hispanics and young voters, which I think ultimately probably do make her the favourite in such a matchup, but and he's not hugely popular within his own establishment. So for all those reasons, you can see how Hillary might wallop him. At the same time, Donald Trump wins the nomination versus a quite vulnerable candidate. I mean, he's got a shot, hasn't he?
I think he has got a shot, yes. Not one that I'm betting on yet, but he has got to. I think
neither am I, but I think we are underestimating his chances.
But the Hillary strength. Remember the New Hampshire primary in January 2008 when she was up against Obama. Obama had won again unexpectedly in the Iowa caucuses a week beforehand. Everybody assumed that, and all the polls were showing that Hillary was going to get beaten in New Hampshire, and absolutely again, completely against everybody's expectations, Hillary had a very good victory in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire is very, I think New Hampshire is actually more important than Iowa, because Iowa is a caucus, and only about 12% of voters take part in the caucuses. Mm. Whereas in New Hampshire, this is a proper election, which is organised by the state authorities, and you go in and you can either be you can vote in either primary. You can say, well, I will vote against Donald Trump. I'll switch and say that I'm a Republican. independents. There's a very strong independent move, and they're likely to sort of capture it. I think that Trump is less. I think it is in a less strong position in New Hampshire than the sort of 20% leads that we're seeing at the moment. There's also the question of Cruz. I mean, there's lots of issues now coming out in relation to his citizenship. He was born in Canada to an American mother. But does that mean that he wasn't a natural born American as the U.S. Constitution requires? And that there's a lot of sort of interesting things coming out suggesting that maybe there is something in this. And I think that the voters are going to, primary voters, are saying, well, I don't. We can't risk having a candidate, a nominee, who might be ruled, might be ineligible. And I wonder whether the latest moves might see moves against Cruz, which could actually benefit people opposed to Mr. Trump. So it might benefit Trump. I don't know, but it throws something into the mix which makes it slightly harder to predict.
It feels like a very salient issue. I think it's very easy to it's a very clear message. This man was not born in the U.S.
Yeah.
Therefore, he is not eligible to be president. Yeah. The counter argument to that is a sort of nuanced argument, legal argument about whether he was born to an American mother. No, I forget which way around it was. I think one of his parents was Cuban, wasn't they? I might be getting my candidates mixed up, but certainly one of his parents at least was American. We were talking off air, weren't we, about how this feels a little bit like Chris Christie, who if he was a front runner, there'd be lots of questions about his health, given that he's been overweight and still is, but I think he's lost quite a lot of weight. This feels like a little bit of a failure of his campaign not to deal with that early doors. But I suppose the counter argument to that, to me, there is that why would you bring it up at the beginning of his candidacy and put all that doubt in people's minds voluntarily? I suppose they hoped it never would come up. I mean, it's often been compared, that race, the GOP race, has often been compared to Jeremy Corbyn's race here, isn't it? Because you've got this kind of, the word moderates bandied about all the time, but in the GOP race, like the Labour race, you had several moderate establishment candidates who can't really break away from one another.
Yeah.
I mean, which of those, do you still share this view that Rubio is the most likely of them to emerge?
I think so, yes. I think Rubio is... has been quiet. I think Rubio might be a beneficiary of growing doubts over Cruz. I think that we might see him being supported by the viable anti-Trump candidate in New Hampshire, which I think might well attract sort of independent and Democrat supports. I think New Hampshire. I think there is a tradition in New Hampshire that any contender from a neighbouring state, of which Bernie Sanders is from Vermont, they always do well. Hillary's got to work cut out in New Hampshire. Though it might be that you might see a return to what happened in 2008, where she won.
Well, certainly lots of dynamics at play there in terms of her travails and so many candidates in the GOP race. People will drop out, and God knows if Trump manages to narrowly miss out on the nomination, does he run as a third party candidate and almost create a rerun of the 1992 election?
Well,
not 100% rerun, of course, because there's no incumbent president. But that's kind of how Bill Clinton won the presidency in the first place.
Indeed, but it becomes harder the longer he stays in the race, because you've got to get on the ballot.
Sore loser, maybe.
Well, no, but to get simply the legal requirements to get on the ballot in certain states, as time goes on, it will be quite hard for him, as I understand it. In some states, each state has its own rules, in the 50 states in the U.S. and you get a different list of contenders for presidency in every state. Because you have to be nominated in each state, and I think that you might see issues if Trump was to do this. I think there's a good chance that Trump will get the nomination, but I will wait till next Saturday evening. I'll be up in the middle of the night waiting for the Des Moines Register poll, Des Moines, that's a leading paper in Iowa.
Yeah.
And it has this fantastic tradition of always getting the trends in the caucuses right. And it's there's a wonderful pollster there who's built up a great specialty in identifying those people who go to caucus meetings. As I say, only 12% of people do. And she just built up this fantastic reputation. She had it last time. She had the Santorum that was, you know, he was going to, you know, do very well. She had it with Obama in 2008. It goes right back. So the DMR poll, the Saturday before the election, that will be the pointer.
That sound you can hear is lots of bookmakers in the UK setting their alarm clocks now for when that poll comes out. Mike Spisson, thanks very much. That was the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. Lots of interesting discussion there. Obviously, the bulk of it around the polling inquiry, I guess. To be continued is probably the headline figure from this week's investigations. But I certainly hope that we can move to a more sort of academic pursuit in terms of how polling is done, because, you know, ultimately, you know, it's very media driven at the moment. That doesn't mean that I want to see 800 grand polls. That's not going to happen. But it would be nice to see if the universities can get much more involved in it. But also if the media and us pundits can tolerate a little bit more of disparity between what the pollsters are saying in the interests of academic pursuit and rigor. But again, as we talked about earlier, when these pollsters are commercial organizations, there isn't really an incentive to be out there on a limb. So it's going to be interesting if the pollsters do have different solutions to this problem, what that then means, and even if some do drop out. And on the US race, we're going to be revisiting that in the next couple of weeks, obviously, as Iowa and New Hampshire emerge. Are we underestimating Trump? Seems perverse to underestimate the front runner, but it does feel like ever since he's announced his candidacy, no one really thinks he's going to do it. Maybe that'll still be true, but we don't necessarily know. And Hillary Clinton, I mean, gun to your head, if someone broke into my house one night and said, who's going to be the next president, you probably would say Hillary Clinton, wouldn't you? She's the most experienced candidate, you know. She's probably going to beat Bernie Sanders. It's not clear who the Republican nominee will be. But at the same time, you know, she has this email problem and, you know, this Clinton problem, if you like, of that element of untrustworthiness about them, at least in the public mind. And you can imagine something emerging in October which really puts the kibosh on her candidacy. So lots of interesting aspects there. But we'll be exploring them in more detail as they go. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening. And do, as ever, like, share, retweet, like the Facebook page, leave us, subscribe on iTunes, leave us comments, all that sort of stuff does get us in front of more people, and we're very keen to grow our audience further. But once again, thanks for listening.